You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. Fewer fish in West Coast waters will be watched over by federal regulators. More from KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe.
Over the last 50 years, a system of co-management between states, tribes, and the federal government has worked to protect fish stocks. It's credited with reducing overfishing, rebuilding stocks, and boosting sustainability. But the federal government says the 500 stocks and species it now helps manage is too much.
There are lots of fish out there. Not everything needs to be managed all the time.
Merrick Burton is executive director of the Pacific Fishery Management Council, which oversees West Coast fisheries plus Idaho. He says cuts from the Trump administration have slashed the staff of the federal regulators and scientists that they work with.
In our region, the estimates are around 40% of their staff, which is staggering. And so this has led to a national conversation of how many species can we really manage?
Last fall, the Pacific Council agreed to remove 39 fish stocks from active federal management. And at its most recent meeting, it removed another 8 stocks. In Washington, this means popular species like blue and Deakin rockfish will no longer be subject to federal catch limits or have essential habitat protection once the cuts are finalized. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe reporting.
Starting next year, students attending Oregon's largest public university will have to pay more in tuition. Oregon State University trustees voted to increase undergraduate tuition by nearly 5% on Friday. OSU President Jayathi Murthy said the increase is vital to the institution.
The tuition increase that I'm asking for is absolutely essential for the well-being of the university. Students always come first, so I don't make this proposal lightly.
Without the tuition hike, OSU is facing a projected $54 million budget shortfall next school year. Student tuition dollars make up the bulk of the university's operating revenues. Some Oregon State trustees said they were uncomfortable with raising prices for students. In Washington state, healthcare providers in Seattle are preparing for more people to come down with the measles ahead of the World Cup. According to Visit Seattle, around 750,000 people are expected to visit the Puget Sound region for 6 soccer matches held at Lumen Field in June. UW's Medicine's Dr. Sharisha Dhanareddy says the measles, which is incredibly infectious, can pose serious health risks that can lead to death.
The severe symptoms of measles can be encephalitis or inflammation of the brain, as well as affecting the lungs, both of which can cause serious disease and critical illness.
The best defense against the disease is getting vaccinated. The measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine is recommended for young children and adults. For infants who are too young to receive these shots, Dhanareddy says the best way to protect them against the measles is to make sure the people around them are vaccinated.
This is KMUN News. I'm Skylar Butenchin. For the past 5 years, a small urban farm in Vancouver, Washington, has grown produce that's culturally specific to Latino communities. But as OPB's Eric Newman reports, lately they've had to change their programs because of increased immigration enforcement.
Dark green poblano chilies, big bunches of cilantro, and red Roma tomatoes fill black plastic crates inside the common room of a housing complex in Woodland, Washington. People buzz around, choosing produce, and trying the pink, yellow, and brown Mexican pastries, or pan dulce, that are laid out on a table near the door. Michelle Vasquez is the executive director of Latinos Unidos y Floreciendo.
We have it set up as a farmers market style where folks could come in and choose the foods that they want to take instead of a food box.
The nonprofit started doing food distributions like this in 2024 in places where it's hard to access healthy produce, in Woodland and Kelso. In the last 6 months, things have changed. Many of their clients are undocumented and are too afraid to go out in public. So now it's often teenagers who come get produce for their families. One little girl who comes for food is just 5 years old.
That one is really heartbreaking for our staff, and our staff will walk her back to her apartment because her mom watches from her apartment window. She's too afraid to leave. So our staff will walk her back up because the grocery bags are too heavy for her.
One visitor, Maria Calderon, holds several bags of vegetables. She plans to use them for molcajete salsa and sopes. Calderon says it's not easy to find good food with everything that's going on. She says she wants to tell people to stay strong and that they shouldn't be afraid to go out. We have to go out for our children, she says. They have to eat. We have to go to work. Stricter immigration enforcement was a pillar of President Donald Trump's platform as a candidate, and it's still one of his administration's priorities. The White House has said mass deportations are, quote, freeing up resources and restoring safety to the American public. But many of those include people with no criminal history. In Washington state, 47% of the arrests from the beginning of Trump's second term through October 15, 2025, were people with no criminal history, according to a February analysis by the Seattle Times. Rachel Festen is the manager of the 10-acre farm the nonprofit runs in Vancouver. Today, she's giving out produce.
They like to talk about what they're going to make with the tomatoes and the poblanos, so we talk about that. And then the little kids are always trying to get extra apples, so that's always fun.
Normally, Festen works with volunteers on the farm, but in recent months, some of them stopped coming. Festen says she tries to keep her interactions at the food distribution events upbeat because of the stress the community is under.
One of the big things is joking around with them. They're always checking to see how my Spanish is doing and testing me. So I try and just be more lighthearted when I'm talking with them.
The nonprofit has had to adapt in other ways, too. Their federal funding from the USDA was frozen last year and then later restored. It's set to expire in May. Vasquez thinks they were targeted because DEI is a big part of their mission. Since then, they've scrubbed diversity language from their websites and social media. Partway through the food distribution, Vasquez gets interrupted by a woman getting produce.
I would take him 2 weeks worth of food because
She says they just got a text message about a mother who got detained the previous night. Her two 11-year-old kids were left behind. Vasquez says those kids will now be supported by the moms in their church. I ask her, where will they live?
They live in the community, and those women know, and they are going to walk that food over to that house and make sure those babies are taken care of.
I mean, in your experience, does that mean those kids end up going to wherever their parents are?
No, they'll stay in the community. This is what we're talking about. This is, you make me choke up, because this is what we're doing.
Vasquez lives in Camas, a nice city east of Vancouver. She says if she wasn't at places like this market or the farm, she could live in a bubble, separate from the effects of the current immigration policies.
How would I know? And it's not about what's on the news. These are real people in our own neighborhoods.
A few minutes later, the tone shifts. Vasquez starts joking with the man who came in for produce. He's drinking a cup of champurrado, a thick hot chocolate drink made with masa. She gives him a hard time because he has diabetes. What happened to your diabetes? She asks. Tomorrow, he says. Tomorrow, he'll deal with his diabetes. That levity is another reason for the market, to create a space where people can share food and be comfortable. I'm Eric Newman, reporting.
Spokane County says a YouTube cottage industry is forcing them to consider charging a fee for body cam footage. Spokane Public Radio's Eliza Billingham reports.
Body cam footage gets quick clicks on YouTube and other social media platforms. But Spokane County Public Records Coordinator Tony DiNaro says it takes a long time to do the proper redaction for those recordings.
We do have a lot of requesters who run monetized YouTube channels, and they make very voluminous requests for body camera footage. Because that has really slowed down our public disclosure process in the sheriff's office, we looked at this possibility of charging in order to recoup some of that time.
DiNaro says according to his team's calculations, any third-party requesters should pay 78 cents per minute of recording. That would cover the time employees spend redacting victims' faces or other sensitive information not included in the Public Records Act. Denaro says anyone involved in a body cam recording would be able to get that footage for free. People can also watch the redacted footage for free if they come into the sheriff's office in person. Denaro says Spokane County is one of the only agencies in the state that doesn't charge a fee, which attracts a lot of YouTubers. He expects a fee would discourage those kinds of requesters. Spokane County will hold a public hearing on the proposal on Tuesday, March 24th at 2 p.m. I'm Eliza Billingham, reporting.
Lots more Airbnbs could be coming to Sandpoint and other Idaho resort towns if the Idaho legislature gets its way. Here's Eliza Billingham once more.
The most extreme version of short-term rental deregulation has passed both the Idaho House and Senate. House Bill 583, sponsored by Coeur d'Alene Rep. Jordan Redman, directs cities statewide to treat vacation rentals like Airbnbs and Vrbos the same as any residential home. That means no business licenses, no safety inspections, no citywide caps. The Idaho Vacation Rental Association and other supporters call it a win for property rights. Opponents, like Sandpoint Mayor Jeremy Grimm, fear it's the death of neighborhoods and affordable housing. While the bill awaits a signature from Idaho Governor Brad Little, the U.S. Senate passed a bipartisan bill aimed at increasing affordable housing. That bill prohibits institutional investors from buying single-family homes, which is in line with an executive order from President Donald Trump. So Idaho's deregulation could conflict with the spirit of the national approach to affordable housing. But some citizens told Idaho legislators that operating a vacation rental on the side is the only way they can afford their own home in their community. I'm Eliza Billingham, reporting.
As the military has eliminated diversity and equal opportunity policies, some advocates say they've also seen the culture change concerning sexual assault and harassment. They say troops may feel less comfortable reporting that they've been victimized. Carson Frame reports for the American Homefront Project.
Soon after the Trump administration moved to end federal DEI programs, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth followed with directives for the military. He banned DEI policies, and bases removed content spotlighting race, sex, color, or ethnicity. Some say it created fear that other programs were in the crosshairs too, including the Army's Sexual Harassment and Assault Prevention and Response Program, known as SHARP.
I saw soldiers going around and ripping SHARP posters off of the wall because they were concerned it was a DEI program.
Rita Graham is an Army veteran and policy director for the Service Women's Action Network.
Because SHARP is associated with women service members, which of course is not the case, and everyone gets assaulted. Man, woman, assault isn't based off of a gender piece.
The Army's SHARP program did remain in place after the directive, but some of the service branches temporarily paused their sexual assault prevention training. Josh Connolly is the senior vice president of Protect Our Defenders, a nonprofit focused on military sexual violence.
There's a real concern within the services to not get crosswise with the secretary. And that means that they, I think, are leaning into training and prevention a lot less.
Advocates and attorneys say the culture around reporting sexual harassment is shifting, with more screening up front and more hesitation about moving cases forward. Ryan Giles is an attorney at Arnold & Porter, who also represents victims pro bono through Protect Our Defenders Legal Support Network.
My sense of the overall environment is that victims of sexual harassment are far less likely to move forward with a case now than they would have been. I don't have the data on it. I'm not aware of any data on it. But the culture suggests that victims no longer are initially believed.
Giles points to a recent Pentagon memo reviewing the military's equal opportunity system, including how it handles sexual harassment complaints from civilian employees. The memo emphasizes the rights of the accused and possible punishment for people who file false reports. A Pentagon spokesperson said in a written statement that the memo does not apply to sexual assault cases. The department says it continues to encourage greater reporting of sexual assault and harassment and remains committed to helping victims and holding offenders appropriately accountable. Still, Rita Graham says the shift in tone is re-triggering symptoms for some survivors, and she worries it could discourage reporting over time.
Service women feel less comfortable to report their assault to their chain of command. They then don't feel comfortable to go to the hospital to get a rape kit. All of these things just compound and ultimately reduce service members' trust and safety in their service.
And as those concerns grow, the Pentagon has dismantled several advisory groups that focused on sexual assault and harassment, including the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services. In a social media post, the department criticized the group as pushing what it called a divisive feminist agenda. The Pentagon says it will still publish its annual sexual assault report, including data on reporting and case outcomes. But it didn't explain why it shuttered the advisory groups. Democratic Congresswoman Chrissy Houlihan of Pennsylvania is an Air Force veteran who serves on the House Armed Services Committee.
There's a lot of anxiety there, not just in the space of sexual assault training and that sort of thing, but just in the larger conversation about whether or not there's a viable career path for women who serve.
Congress has forced the Pentagon to reinstate some of the advisory groups that it tried to eliminate. And Houlihan says she plans to continue to pressure the Pentagon, arguing that military readiness depends on dignity and respect for service members. This is Carson Frame reporting.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. That includes me, News Director Katie Frankowitz, and, through the end of today, host and production assistant Skylar Butenshin. This is when I let you all know that this is Skylar's last newscast for KMUN. He is moving away and on to, we hope, bigger and even better things. Skylar has been an instrumental part of the station for several years, and he's left things in a really good place in the news department. We'll be welcoming his replacement at the end of April. I hope to have more information to share as we get closer to that time. For now, thank you, Skylar, for all you've done for KMUN. We will really miss you. In other station news, our spring pledge drive begins tomorrow. As regular listeners and KMUN members know, we lost a huge chunk of funding last summer when the Trump administration clawed back federal funds for public media. This is money that normally we'd expect to get every year. We made a lot of cuts to get through last year, famously slashing all of the NPR programming that we previously carried. This impacted our programming across a lot of hours in the day, and it certainly impacted the news hours and the KMUN News Department. But our community really stepped up last year. We had a record pledge drive in the fall, and we are looking to hit some ambitious numbers again this spring. Over the next week, you'll hear about our pledge drive from our programmers and from community members who drop by the station. They will give you all kinds of reasons for why they think you should support your local community radio station. If you want to get a jump on donating, you can. Just go to KMUN.org and click on the red donate button up in the corner. You can also call us during regular business hours at 503-325-0010. Thank you, as always, for your support. Thank you for listening. This is KMUN, your community radio station.